So we're about, I don't know how long, 8 hours, 9 hours away from that hallowed evening that we celebrate here in America. And probably all of you know the word hallow means sacred. We use it mostly, I think, in two different contexts in America. With hallowed ground is usually a battleground for patriots have died, isn't it? Something like that, or cemeteries where they are. And then we talk about Halloween, the evening of the hallow, of the sacred. And it's associated, the reason it's called that is that it's the night before All Saints Day. And so November 1st, back in England, I guess, or wherever, was All Saints Day, and which is, you know, imagine with all the saints coming together in one day, it's a pretty sacred, wonderful day. And so here we have the evening before all the saints come, all the demons and goblins and ghosts and all the kind of things we usually don't associate with the sacred come visiting. They have their last hurrah or something. And now the, you know, kind of the maybe odd thing that's happened in America is that Halloween has been domesticated. And so we have these wonderful demons that come around who are about 3, 4 feet tall and knock at our doors. Or some people have Halloween parties, but mostly it's kind of a domesticated tradition. Some people come as angels and all kinds of things, but they're kind of domesticated, they're tame, they're relatively safe. However, you don't have to go too far back in history to realize that even angels were terrifying beings. And people had wrestled with them and fought with them, and they fought with each other. So I think it's, you know, kind of one of the few times in our culture where we kind of give some kind of lip service to respecting or honoring or calling forth that side of life which we can call, you know, non-sacred. And if we allow for this kind of distinction between the sacred and the profane, the sacred and the demonic, sacred and the hidden, the sacred and the unacknowledged, the kind of pushed away or the repressed, if we live in that kind of world, then it becomes very important to somehow honor, respect, call forth occasionally that side which is pushed down or repressed or hidden. I don't know if we need to live in that kind of duality between the sacred and the profane, sacred and whatever. And I think that Buddhist practice is trying to point us in the direction of trying to heal those kinds of divisions. So we don't have some idea of some sacred realm apart from some profane realm, but that all of life is what it is. We might want to call it sacred, or we might want to call it just what it is. Just life is what it is. It is what it is before the mind separates into these dualities. But it's such a strong tendency in human minds and human culture to create dualities, to create these divisions. And then once we have divisions, there's what's preferred and not preferred. There's what we're willing to look at and not willing to look at. And Buddhist culture has it as much as any culture. I think probably every time you get human beings together, you get a culture gets created. And there's families cultures and neighborhood cultures and, you know, national cultures, all kinds of cultures. And cultures, by their nature, tend to focus on what holds people together, what creates harmony, what creates healthy or relatedness among people. And so there's often certain values that do that. And those values then get championed and honored. And those values or those ways of being which don't relate to that kind of way of being then often gets ignored or pushed aside, or people are kind of shy to show that side of themselves. And here, and what I've seen in many of the Buddhist environments that I've been in, it's very common for Buddhists to champion values like kindness, compassion, being peaceful, being calm, all kinds of great things that Buddhists are supposed to be. And when you have a culture like that, then the opposite of that tends not to be, you know, you don't feel so free to say it. I mean, you come to IMC and, you know, most people are kind of polite and nice and kind, and we don't growl at each other that often and yell, and we don't, you know, show people, you know, our horrible anger, demonic anger, and how were you this last week? Well, you know, fine. you know, I was possessed by some kind of demon of wrath, and I was ready to kind of, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's not a very Buddhist thing to do. And so people sometimes aren't willing to talk about that side of themselves so much in these kinds of circles. So it can be said that kind of the shadow side of Buddhist culture is sometimes is anger. Or sometimes Buddhists don't want to show their anger so much. And this is what I've seen in many Buddhist environments I've been in. Of course, there are exceptions. And sometimes there's those exceptions we wish weren't exceptions. That person is always. And but I think any culture has this kind of shadow side. And it's very important to realize that. And then a culture, a society, an individual, a people, need to find some way to bring that to light. And so Halloween, in a sense, perhaps is an attempt to do that. Some people call it, you know, their alter ego. They dress up as their alter ego, or they dress up at what they're most afraid of, or they dress up in some aspect of themselves they haven't really had a chance to kind of act out so well. And so it's a kind of a chance to bring something to light that is often not brought to light. I like to think that in contrast to culture, Buddhist culture, the function of Buddhist practice is to bring these things to light. And maybe in the privacy of our own practice, you don't have to necessarily demonstrate it to everybody else. But part of the function of practice is to kind of break the division, break the walls between that we might have between what's preferred and not preferred, between what we think is appropriate and not appropriate, between the sacred and the profane. So it all can arise equally, freely, into the psyche, into the mind, into awareness. And then once it arises into awareness, then to learn how to be free, liberated in the midst of all that, and no longer living that some kind of the divisions we often tend to live in. So the function of the practice is to, in part, is to bring out what is often ignored or repressed. And for some people, it's not the demonic, but it's the what's most beautiful. There are some people for whom the beauty that they are is not something they're willing to face and look at. They're shy about it, or embarrassed, or just it goes against the grain, or goes against their religious upbringing, that what's most beautiful or joyful in them can be honored and respected. So the part that's often repressed or hidden can be a wide range of phenomena, both beautiful and ugly. But it's a function of practice to really let all of it come up. And I find it quite wonderful and joyful and liberating that I have a practice that, you know, that I don't have to censor myself. That at least I might censor myself a little bit in public at times, but because maybe it's not appropriate to say what's in my mind exactly. But at least in my practice or my practice relationships and relationships I've had with my teachers, for example, those are relationships or that's a place within me that I'm not going to censor, but rather try to bring everything to awareness to really see what it actually is. And unless we have some kind of healthy relationship to that which we don't want to look at in ourselves, what we don't want to look at is going to fester and cause difficulties and problems. It's been pointed out that in some cultures they have carnivals. And carnivals are a time to release social pressure. Sometimes carnivals are designed so that society gets turned upside down and the hierarchies of society are kind of turned up topsy-turvy. And so it releases a lot of the pressure that builds up when you have a fixed society and fixed hierarchies and rules and lines of authority. And carnival is a time where everybody just lets loose and releases the steam. And that lasts, you know, for another year until they have the next carnival, perhaps. In East Asia, in Buddhist East Asia, they have a ceremony, a ritual that in Japanese is called segaki. And segaki means feeding the hungry ghosts. And when I was in the Zen monastery in Japan, we spent a whole month feeding the hungry ghosts. They had this little altar in the Buddha hall, and we had this whole ceremony and chanting and all the stuff we had to do. And it was all about feeding these hungry ghosts. And it was a lot about first inviting them to come into the temple, inviting them to be present, inviting these ghosts and to be there. And then at the end of the month, after you fed them and gave them Dharma talks and all these wonderful things to these ghosts, then you sent them back, and to wherever they came from, and until next year when they're invited back, and you do the same thing. And I was kind of surprised by a lot of things I saw in the Zen monastery in Japan. I had grown up kind of in the Western Zen Buddhism, and it's just like, you know, very, to be very simplistic, it was kind of, you know, well, to tell you a little story, D.T. Suzuki, someone like that, or maybe John Cage, influenced by D.T. Suzuki in the 50s, got up on a stage and pointed to some kind of, I don't know, it was a painting or some of the, you know, the wall behind him and said, you know, what is that? Pointing to this blue kind of painting or something. And people in the audience started apparently making all kinds of ideas and telling me what it was. And finally he said something like, it's just blue. And because they were interpreting and making all kinds of stories of what it might be. And sometimes blue is just blue. Sometimes a rock is just a rock. You look at it and it doesn't have to be anything else. And there's something about Zen training where you learn to see things directly as they are, just be in the present moment with how things are without any kind of complicated elaboration. And then I went to a Zen monastery in Japan, and it was populated with deities of all kinds. I couldn't believe it. It was the most populated deity, you know, I don't know if deity is the right word, but spirits and ghosts and, you know, they had, one of the surprises, once a month we went up to this little hut up in the mountainside, and we recited the Perfection of Wisdom literature. We didn't recite it, we kind of had this ritual. Perfection of Wisdom literature is really this really long book, really, really long book. And it would take years to go recite the whole thing. But you have this accordion fan-like book, and what you do is you go, and then you've read it. And you do that a few times. But the deity that was being appeased or taught or something was the goddess of the Ganges. What in the world was the goddess of the Ganges doing in a Japanese Zen monastery? I mean, that was in India. There's like Indians who do the, you know, goddess of the Ganges. And then at the beginning of the practice period, we did this whole thing about kind of, I forget exactly how it went, but somehow relating with kindness and generosity to the spirits of the place. Each place had spirits. And if you're going to do a practice period, if you're going to spend this retreat time in a particular place, you want to somehow relate to those spirits and ask permission to practice and ask for their support. And then we had these hungry ghosts that came for a whole month. It was quite a wild place. And it was the first place where I met someone who actually said they met a ghost. One of the monks said back at his home temple, he'd seen ghosts, and the way you take care of ghosts in Japan is you chant the Heart Sutra. So he chanted the Heart Sutra, and that took care of that. Why am I telling you all this? the Sagaki, that's why. So this month-long thing. So what happens here in the West is, in Western Zen circles, many of them, is they've adopted the Sagaki ceremony. But rather than having it in Japan in July, when it's usually done, around July, it's done, they do it at Halloween. Some of you have been to the Obon ceremony that Japanese temples do. That's part of that. It's part of the whole same thing. And what they do on Halloween in Zen traditions, they have a ceremony called Sagaki, Feeding the Hungry Ghosts. And it's done to feed two different kinds of hungry ghosts, recognize, acknowledge two different things. One is people who have died over the last year in recent times, for whom we still have karmic connections or unworked karmic connections for. So to evoke their spirit, evoke their presence, evoke the memories of them. And somehow in that, in their evoked presence, and evoked memories of them, to try to resolve or finish or complete or acknowledge something that needs to happen in that relationship to the people who have passed away, or to feed them. And the other is to acknowledge something about ourselves, the hungry ghost, the unacknowledged that we haven't seen in ourselves. So one of the chants that's done in the Zen Center, they say at the ceremony, welcome hungry ghosts Be at ease, the vaguely known, the unconscious and unknown. Welcome, be safe. Isn't that great? When's the last time you said that to yourself? Be safe and let whatever comes, let it come. Be safe. You're welcome here. Here's another version, or another thing that's chanted sometimes as part of this ceremony in Japanese Zen temples. We invite all diseased ancestors, the spirits of mountains, rivers, and earth, and all the demons of untamed lands to come and assemble here. Now, with compassion and empathy, we offer each of you food. We sincerely hope that each and every one of you will receive our offering, turn it over, and pass it on to all sentient beings throughout the realm of vast emptiness. May you and all sentient beings together be fully satisfied. Again, we hope your bodies will be conveyed by these offerings and mantras so that you may let go of all suffering, attain liberation, be born in heaven, receive joy, and play freely in the pure lands of the ten directions. So Sagaki then is transported into Halloween in the West, and then at this time to invite all the different these spirits, the unseen, the demonic, the difficult, the hidden, various, and invite them and help them make them feel safe, and then in some way feed them. And the question is, what does it mean to feed the unseen, to feed that which is repressed or hidden? And I think each of you needs to answer that for yourself. You know, it's different things at different times. But to feed it, to not just push it away, but to actually feed it. There's a story I don't remember so well, but I'll just make it up, but I don't remember. That's how the stories began anyway. It's just that usually they don't admit it, that they're made up. Of Milarepa, a great Tibetan yogi, who spent a long time practicing in a cave high up in the mountains. And he was off away from his cave one day, and he came back, and his cave was visited by five demons. Gruesome demons. Big teeth, you know. Teeth the size of forks, you know. Big gaping mouths with blood dripping down. And tears of blood streaming down from their eyes, and bloodshot eyes. And, you know, claws the size of chainsaws. Fiery breath. And he went into his cave, and there were these five demons. And he said, oh. So the first thing he did was he growled back at them and said, arr. And kind of threatened to attack. Well, one of them ran away. And the other four started advancing onto him. So that didn't work well enough. So then he changed tactics. And he said, it's good to see you. Welcome. You know, inviting them. Welcome, it's good to see you. You know, what can I do for you? Why don't you stay for a while? I'll make you tea. And with that, two of them vanished. But then two were left, and they were the fiercest, meanest, baddest demons of them all. Is that right? Did I count right? That's not how I meant to tell the story. The first time was, I mean, when he was growled at them, two of them disappeared. That's what, okay? And the second time when he offered kindness, two more disappeared. And then, but then the meanest one kept approaching. And big open teeth dripping in blood, ready to kind of snap all over Milarepa. And he tried two tricks he had, so he didn't know what else to do. So what he did was he just laid himself down in the mouth of the demon. And with that, the demon vanished, and he found himself sitting peacefully in his meditation cave. So he fed himself to the demon. And so different ways, different approaches. Sometimes we want to meet what's difficult with our ferocity, and that's appropriate. Sometimes we want to meet what's difficult with tremendous kindness and gentleness, and that's what's appropriate. And sometimes we want to just feed it, support it, help it along, with ourselves, feed ourselves, place ourselves in it. And one of the things that means is when there's something strong energy, strong emotions that arise, or strong things, with our mindfulness, the power of our mindfulness, especially if we've built up a certain strength of mindfulness, to use that ability to be present and place ourselves right in the middle of our strongest feelings. Kind of bring our attention and place ourselves right there. It's great to do it in meditation practice where you don't have to act and do anything. Just sit there and let these forces kind of bubble up and just sit in the middle of them and feed yourself to them with the idea, when you feed yourself to a demon like that, you're not trying to get rid of it. See, the first two approaches, Milarepa was trying to get rid of the demons through these different tactics. But the last one, he gave up trying to get rid of it and just surrendered to it, gave himself to it. A friend of mine had a dream many years ago that he was holding a poisonous snake by the neck. And he couldn't let go. It's safe that way, right? Because it can't bite you. But, you know, after a while, your arm gets tired and he wanted to let go of it. But he couldn't let go of it because then it would be free. It could, you know, come back and bite him. So he didn't know what to do. So in the dream, he was going around like this and wondering what to do. And finally in the dream, he let go of the snake. And the moment he let go of the snake vanished. Isn't that a great dream? So sometimes the moment we let go of our grip or our aversion to things and just place ourselves in the middle of it, allow it to be there in an unconditioned, complete way, then sometimes it's no longer the frightening thing that it was, or it's no longer even there sometimes. It doesn't happen often that quickly. And also it doesn't work very well if you're going to unconditionally feed yourself to the demon, accept it completely that its presence there, so that it'll go away. Then it doesn't work either. So it's a little bit, you know, so then how do you do this? And sometimes you can't really do it. Occasionally, it's something you can't really do, but it's something that you're forced to do when you have to give up. And sometimes in spiritual practice, there will come a time when you're up against the wall and you're kind of trying, and you realize it's hopeless, and all you can do is give up. Give up everything. And only then does something happen when you really give up. And I've been in situations like that where I try to give up. And I'll give up. And, you know, nothing was happening. It was just awful. And finally, you know, I couldn't give up, but just like, oh, it's hopeless. And then something changes. So the demonic, or the beautiful, the hidden, the repressed, that which we don't want to look at. And sometimes it's helpful to have rituals, because it's hard sometimes for the psyche to really evoke these things or give them expression, unless sometimes we do a ritual or we do a ceremony or we do a party. Some of you maybe went to, there was a party last night called, what was it called? For Buddhists? What was the whole title? Many of you want to admit being there? Just that was it called, Hungry Ghosts? For all Buddhists? And here are some demons from early Buddhism. They're ferocious. They're dangerous. They will sap your life away. They will destroy many of the things that it encounters. Not always, but it can. They're worse than Milarepa's fierce demons in his cave. See if you identify any of these in yourself. Sensual desire, discontent, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and torpor, fear, doubt, obstinacy, praise and fame, slander and disparaging others. Pretty good list, huh?
What's left?
Those are the 10 armies of Mara. 10 armies of the kind of Buddhist devil. So there are a number of approaches to the demonic, some of which I've talked about. One way is more kind of external. And that is association with things that are with wise friends or pure friends, association with that which is kind of pure in relationship to maybe what is most very difficult. In the Japanese Buddhist pantheon of bodhisattvas, Japanese Buddhism or Mahayana Buddhism has this whole pantheon of almost godlike figures called bodhisattvas. They're called sometimes called celestial bodhisattvas, and they're all kind of archetypes. And all these archetypes have functions, as archetypes do. And all these archetypes, when they're depicted in human form, are depicted as lay people. Household people, people, you know, just like us. Most of us, I think, are lay. And except for one. And that one, his name is, in Japanese, is Jizo Bodhisattva. And Jizo is the Bodhisattva for a variety of things, variety of people. It's a Bodhisattva of children. But it's also the Bodhisattva of people who are really down and out. People who have really gone to the depths of despair. People who are maybe depths of dealing with some addiction issues and just kind of you know, it can be pretty dire. The depths of you know, nothing can reach into sometimes to people. You can't even talk to them. You can't really help. There's no way to get to them. Things are so dire and difficult and so deluded or caught in their addiction. And Jizo is the archetype that speaks to those people. I think because he's the only one who's a monk, and the monk is the archetype of purity. That somehow, that archetype can sometimes speak to people, get their attention that other things can't. And it's still, I think, very much true, I think, in our modern society, that people who are clearly identified as monks or as religious people, you know, somehow people gravitate to them or see them in different ways. Before I became a Zen monk and shaved my head and wore robes, I was this long-haired hippie, long beard and long hair down to here. And some people either ignored me, or, the cool people would say, "Hey, man." But, there certainly was, a lot of people just ignored me. I'd sit on airplane seats and the person next to me wouldn't talk to me the whole time there. But once I was ordained as a priest, I noticed that everyone would come talk to me. All these kinds of categories of people who didn't want anything to do with me before. Now they would walk up to me in bus stops and introduce themselves and talk to me. And people would tell me these amazing things about their life. And the only thing that happened is I shaped my head, you know. Somehow that archetype, that image, has a very, very profound one for the human psyche. I've had two friends who, in their moments of despair, saw photographs of on the wall of Ramana Maharshi. And seeing that photograph turned their whole life around. Kind of just, oh. And, you know, seeing that face, Ramana Maharshi was a great Indian saint. And somehow just a photograph of it kind of, you know, in their deepest despair, somehow caught their attention. So this is kind of like using duality to heal duality. So sometimes when people are in the depth of some great dualistic despair, sometimes you use the opposite end of the duality to kind of bring some kind of, to pull them out. Some people like to turn to a power that's greater. Rather than matching duality for duality, turn to some power that's greater than what's most difficult. And there's many things people use for that. I would like to suggest that in the mindfulness tradition of Vipassana, that the power that's greater than almost anything is the power of awareness, of attention. It's a power which we develop and strengthen with its use, but it's a tremendously powerful force, the force of attention. And it has the ability to handle and meet anything that arises, any difficulty, anything that's threatening and challenging. And it's a wonderful thing to have developed that power and that ability of awareness itself to hold what is going on. And awareness itself then allows us the power of seeing things as they are. Seeing things as they are, unclouded by the dualism of, you know, before and after, or dualism of better and, you know, good and bad, or even self and other sometimes. Just to see things as they are can be very, very freeing. But that means really being willing to see things as they are, being willing to see ourselves as we are, being willing to see that which is beautiful about ourselves and that which is difficult about ourselves, to see the whole range of ourselves, unfiltered, uncensored, who we actually are. And that means occasionally be able to see the really horrible, really difficult. I remember once going to see one of my Zen teachers, and you know, usually you go to a teacher and it's peaceful, you know, you sit in this interview and you sitting in meditation posture together, and you know, you have this nice talk, and the person, the teacher, just sitting there, and you know, responds, and you know, in whatever way. But it's basically a calm and peaceful thing. And I forget exact words he used, but the teacher suddenly kind of leaned forward and opened his eyes wide and his mouth and his hands like, it was like, I mean, I'm a demon. What? Where'd that come from? So you never know when you see these Zen teachers what you're going to meet. And but to have some place where these things can bubble up is very important, and learn how to be present for it. The famous story, the kind of almost told so often, it's the liturgy of our tradition, of Mara coming to see the Buddha, and the Buddha, Mara is the Buddhist devil, and the Buddha just saying to Mara, "Mara, I see you," and Mara runs away. And it's a nice story, but you think of something about seeing that's really, really profound and important. And of course, Buddha can say, "I see you," because he really knew Mara well. Some people can say, "I see you, Mara," but we don't really know Mara well. Anger, I see you, but you don't really know your anger. Fear, I see you, you don't really know your fear. But to really know something well, to really spend time with it, getting familiar with it, being present for it, and let it come into awareness, to really know something so well, that the power of saying, "I see you," is all that's needed to become free of it. And that takes familiarity, takes getting to know something. Naming it is very freeing. We can understand that to some degree, the demonic within ourselves, the difficult within ourselves, the repressed within ourselves, is the disowned parts of our personality. As long as they're not integrated, they'll still appear as demons. But once we've learned to integrate them or hold them in awareness and see them, they stop being demonic. So there are many different classes of this kind of unseen world, and one class is called the hungry ghosts. Tonight's the night of the ghosts, and hungry ghosts are those beings which have huge hungry mouths and huge, even bigger, huge, huge hungry bellies, and then they have these throats that are, you know, as thin as a matchstick. And no matter how much they kind of try to, you know, eat, they just can't get enough food down that throat fast enough to fill their belly. So they're always hungry, always wanting more and more and more and more and more and more. Kind of like a six-year-old. Sometimes. And something about the nature of desire that can make people into hungry ghosts. And then there's the asuras, which are kind of like sometimes called the jealous gods. And they're the gods, they're kind of beings that are always jealous of others who have really wonderful things. And there's some demonic that arises in that jealousy and can destroy a lot of things in life. And they're always fighting against the gods because they're jealous. And then there's the realm, in Buddhist cosmology, of the fear realm, those beings which are motivated and driven by fear. And whether it's we like it or not, you might not like what the Buddhists say about this, but the fear realm is the animal realm. Animals are said to represent fear. And then there's the hell realms, the realms where just unremitting suffering goes on for a long time. So Halloween has been domesticated, but it's something that we have to remember. We shouldn't be too domestic about it. We shouldn't. We should be. I think it's important to be very respectful of this realm that Halloween is pointing towards, and understand that it's not necessarily something which is, you know, lightweight or something just simply to play in, but it's something really to be very important and serious part of human life, and the playfulness can be useful and be helpful in many ways. But we're talking about very deep forces within the human heart and human psyche. And sometimes we need to call forth powers, forces of compassion, forces of love, forces of strength, in order to be able to meet these kinds of forces within us. And certainly forces of wisdom to know how to approach these things and what to do. When I noticed that a lot of the stories that my son, fairy tales that my son encounters at school, have to do with vanquishing the dragons and demons. And I think it's fine, it may be healthy for kids to learn that side of human life. But what I don't hear is the opposite, which is how to befriend the demons and dragons. So at home, I tell them stories, I make up stories about befriending dragons and demons and hoping that he gets the idea that sometimes you want to turn around and face these things. And so I'll end with one short story that many of you have heard. I love the story because it's the kind of story that even though you might know it, you're supposed to figure out how it applies to your life anew every time you hear it. So it's always new that way. And that's a story of the ugly runt of a little troll that jumped up on the throne of the great Brahma, the great god, the great Zeus of the Indian pantheon. And no one but Brahma sits on that throne. And this ugly runt of a little yaksha, of a troll, got up there. And all the other gods in court got angry and upset. And the more they got angry and upset and told him to get off that throne, the bigger and stronger, more beautiful that troll, that yaksha got. And they got confused. So they went and found Brahma. He was off someplace. So there's something unusual that's happening back on your throne. And they explained, and he said, oh. So he went back. I know what to do, he said. And he went back. And there he saw this beautiful, radiant, strong, huge being. By that time, he'd gotten really. And he said, oh, I'm happy to see you. I hope you're comfortable up there. It's nice. I haven't seen you for a long time. And bowed to him. And as he offered his kindness, respect, his acknowledgement of him being up there, the troll got smaller and smaller and runtier and uglier, smaller, and finally he got so small he just disappeared. And then Brahma got up back up on his throne, and he said, explained, that little yaksha, that little troll, is an anger-eating troll. And the more anger you express around it, the greater it, more it thrives. It feeds on your anger. But if you stop feeding it anger, then it just withers away. So that's what he did. Brahma came and stopped being angry. So may you know what to feed and what not to feed. And may you enjoy Halloween. So thank you.